During the intensive training in Virginia necessary for the absorption of vital technical and military information, Johnny and Raymond's mother lived in a darling little cottage just outside Wellville in Nottoway County, where she had found a solid connection for black market booze and gasoline, and a contact for counterfeit red points to keep those old stakes coming in. Johnny moved out of the staging area and sailed with his outfit for Greenland in December 1942, and Raymond's mother went back home to handle the PR work for her man. The recurring theme she chose for the first year of propaganda was hammered out along the basic lines of, "Blessed is he who serves, who is not called. Blessed is he who sacrifices self to bring about the downfall of tyrants, that others may prosper in liberty." It was solid stuff. She got herself a women's radio show and a women's interest newspaper column in the Journal, the biggest paper in the state and one of the best in the country. There were a lot of specialized jobs going for the asking. Mainly, she read or reprinted all of Johnny's letters on every conceivable variety of subject, whether he sent her any letters or not. The official records show that Johnny was an intelligence officer in the Army, but his campaign literature, when Raymond's mother ran him for governor, revealed that he had been a Northern Greenland combat commander. About 10 years after the war was over, well after Johnny's second term as governor, the Journal did a surprising amount of careful research on Johnny's record, at considerable expense. They dug up documents and men who had served with Johnny, and they virtually reconstructed a most careful, pertinent, and accurate history of his somewhat distorted past. A public relations officer who had been attached to Iceland's unit, a Lieutenant Jack Raymond, now of San Mateo, California, told the Journal in 1955 on a transcribed, long-distance telephone tape recording, which was monitored by the Journal's city editor, Fred Goldberg, and witnessed by a principal clergyman and a leading physician of the state, of the lonely incident that had lent credence to the popular belief that Johnny had seen combat while in service. "Yeah," Raymond said. "I remember the day we were both at a tiny Eskimo settlement above Etah, there on Smith Sound, and Johnny was looking to make some kind of good trades on furs with the natives, when a supply ship, the name of Midshipman Bennett Rays, came in, covered all over with ice. They were having propeller trouble, and they were due in at Etah to unload groceries, and while they were standing by for repairs, the skipper told them to test the guns. All the guns. Everything. We find out about it when Johnny and I go aboard. We were off duty, and Johnny always operates under orders from his wife to make friends, no matter where. He actually brought the skipper of that ship, the stiffest piece of sealskin you ever saw, and made such a big thing out of it that the guy probably even kept it. He gave Johnny a half gallon of pure grain alcohol to show his appreciation, and we needed it. Man, was it cold. I can never, ever explain to anybody how cold it was all the time I was in the Army. And, for what reason, please don't ask me, the cold absolutely does not ever seem to bother Johnny. He used to say it was because his nose was radioactive. Actually, he was always so full of antifreeze that he couldn't feel much of anything. Anyway, Johnny hears these Navy guys cursing about having to test all the guns, and he asks them if they will mind if he fires a few rounds, because he has always wanted to shoot a gun of some kind, any kind. They look at each other quick. They say, sure, he can fire every single gun on the ship if he likes. So he did, and he took some pretty rugged chances, because if the Martians had attacked or he had slipped on the deck, he could have hurt himself. Anyway, I had a job to do which was called public relations, so I wrote a little routine story about the one-man battleship, which in a certain way was strictly true. It had a certain Army flavor, and after all, they weren't paying me to do public relations for the Navy, you know what I mean? I slugged it from an Arctic outpost of the U.S. Army, and I wrote how one lone Army officer had fired all the guns of a fighting ship on top of the world where all the forgotten battles are fought, and where the Navy fighting men had been put out of action by the cruelest enemy of all, the desperate bitter cold of the Arctic night, and how when the last gun had been stilled, not an enemy form or an enemy plane could be seen moving on the ancient ice cap, tomb of thousands of unknown fallen. You know, it was filler copy. Not strictly a lie, you understand. Every fact was strictly factual, all by itself, but, well, it was what they always said was very, very good for morale on the home front, you know what I mean? Anyway, I forgot about the whole thing until Johnny came around with a fistful of clippings and a letter from his wife, which said my story was worth 50,000 votes, and he was supposed to buy me all the gin I could hold. I liked gin at the time, Raymond concluded. With characteristic candor, in his autobiographical sketch in the Congressional Directory of 1955, Johnny claimed 17 Arctic combat missions. But when testifying in 1957 in a legal proceeding that was attempting to investigate various amounts of unusual income he had received, both as to amount and source, Johnny said of himself, "Iselin was on 31 combat missions in the Arctic, plus liaison missions," and added inexplicably that the nights in the Arctic region were 6 months long. "Iselin saw enough battle action to keep him peaceful and quiet for the rest of his days." Raymond's mother had taught Johnny to call himself Iselin whenever testifying or being interviewed, on the principle that it constituted a continuing plug for the name at a time when Johnny was being quoted on land, sea, and in the air as often and as much as the New York Stock Exchange. The question of combat would not permit any settlement. When Raymond's mother had Johnny make formal application for the Silver Star, presumably because no one else had made application for him, in a claim supported by certain certified copies from my personal military records, it attracted an apoplectically outraged letter of complaint from a constituent, bitter about the violation of propriety in which Johnny had received a medal at his own request. Raymond's mother dictated, and Johnny signed, a return letter that contained this brave turn of phrase: "I am bound by the rules which provide how such awards shall be made, and as much as I felt distaste, there just wasn't any other way to do it." However, as the years carried Big John and Raymond's mother forward through their national and international duels on behalf of a more perfect America, the most disputed part of Johnny's record continued to be the wound he most blandly claimed to have suffered in military combat. Although he did not receive the Purple Heart, and although the former Secretary of the Army who reviewed his personnel file disclaimed any isolated wound in action, when Big John was asked at a veterans rally why he wore built-up shoes, "How else the big in Big John?" Governor Iselin said he was wearing the shoes because he had lost most of his heel in Arctic combat. There is disagreement among those who heard him at that time as to whether he said, "lost most of my foot," or a lesser amount of tissue. The Relentless Journal, in the year of its gallant but futile attempt to discredit Johnny in a meaningful sense, uncovered the personal journal of an officer who had served with Johnny all during the tour, a Francis Winnicus, who subsequently made a reputation as an authority on migratory elements of population in Britain and Europe. Under the date of June 22, 1944, the Winnicus diary threw a white and revealing light on the circumstances leading to Johnny's wound by recording, "Johnny Iselin has become possessed by the idea of sex. To get that interested in sex on the top of this ice cap is either suicidal or homosexual on its surface, but Johnny isn't either. He is a persistent and determined zealot. There is a new Eskimo camp about 3 miles across that primordial field of ice under that gale of wind which carries those flying razor blades to cut into the face from the direction of the village. There are women there. Everybody knows that, and everybody agreed it was a very good thing, until we walked, secretly and one at a time with ice grippers tied to our shoes, across that shocking 3 mile course in cold worse than the icy hell the old German religions called Niflheim, and came up to the igloos downwind, and lost all interest in sex for the rest of the war. I was exhausted when I made the run, but I came back faster than I went over to get away from that smell. It is the special smell of the Eskimo women, and there is no smell like it, because they wash their hair in stored urine, they live sewed up in those musty skins, and they eat an endless diet of putrescent food, like fish heads and whale fat." Johnny said he was going to get around those surface disadvantages, because he had to have a woman, or the top of his head would come off. He has been practicing 11 days, making that run over and back every single day. The cold and the wind simply do not seem to exist for him. All he can think of is the women. He comes back here and rests and moans and bleats with his longing, and he says proudly that he is getting used to the stink of the women. He says that if Eskimo men went to Chicago and smelled our women wearing those expensive French perfumes, that it would sicken them too, and that all these things are just a matter of getting used to them. Yesterday, he decided he was ready. He crossed the ice cap again in that blackness, following a compass and watching for the lights, if any. He filled me in on the whole story this morning before they took him out in the sled to Etah, where they will hold him for pickup by relief plane to Gatab. He was welcomed, hospitably, he said, about 30 yards outside a lot of ice mounds, which turned out to be igloos. Johnny doesn't speak their language, and they don't speak Johnny's. But he used his hands so suggestively. Well, what he did with his hands when he was telling me how he showed them what he wanted makes me wonder how I will be able to get through the winter. He says they were completely sympathetic and immediately understanding, and motioned him to crawl behind them into one of the blocks of ice. Before he entered, he distributed some K-rations, and he told me he remembered thinking how easy this was going to be as soon as he could figure out which were the women and which were the men, because they were all wrapped in furs and their faces were as round and flat and shiny as a silver dollar. He made it into the igloo on his hands and knees, then almost fainted from the smell. He had gotten used to the smell of the women in a high Arctic wind outside the snow houses. The heat was tremendous, for one thing. Hot bricks, body heat, burning blubber, and smoking dried moss and lichens. Artfully placed around the perimeter were leather buckets of straight-aged urine. Johnny said he must have stumbled into the local beauty parlor. His other quick impression was that a considerable amount of last season's fish had rotted. And, too, there was the smoky, blinding smell of long-imprisoned feet.